listener.
WMFO Medford. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Voicemobile. I hope you are well. I'm getting a funny signal. What is that? I'm not sure. Let's see. Oh, maybe just the volume was up a little bit high. Okay, so hope everybody dug out from the blizzard. That was quite fun. As long as you didn't have to be anywhere. Thank goodness I have wonderful neighbors who helped me. When I first came out of my back door to get to my car, it was the blocked door, and like many of you probably had. I had to shovel my way out, and I took about maybe 10 minutes to go 6 feet, and that was barely a third of what I had to do, and I went back in. When I came out again in half an hour, I found that one of my neighbors had dug me out all the way to my car, dug around the car. God bless. I mean, just incredible. And, I had to take the snow off my car, of course, and around it a little bit. But the big thing, the berm, the huge thing that the snow plows leave, they chipped away and chipped away and chipped away. And thank goodness I didn't have to be anywhere. So I'm extremely grateful for their help. Also, on another front, I'm still looking for a two-bedroom apartment that will accept me and a cat and my stuff, a washer-dryer hookup, looking for that. I have one possibility tomorrow, and I'm praying that that's going to work. If anybody has any ideas, you can email me at thevoicemobile@gmail.com. All that good stuff. So what else is going on? Well, of course, Tom Brady. I'm really glad for his family that he made that decision, because I was praying that nothing serious accident-wise would happen to him, and that, you know, he would have a full and wonderful life beyond the football field, with all the stories that you hear of the injuries, the head injuries, and so forth. He's provided incredible entertainment. I'm not so much of a football fan, but how could you not watch Tom Brady? And when he left here, I missed him. I really did. And I never really cottoned much to the new configuration of the Patriots. And as far as, you know, my two cents about the whole kerfuffle, I think there's a lot of things that went on behind the scenes that we aren't privy to. And I think he just probably, you know, had his fill of whether it was, I don't know. Anyway, it doesn't matter really much what I think. I'm sure he'll go on to do other incredible things. He's done a lot of good in the community. And we were lucky to have had his playing, his excitement. And only once in a lifetime do you find a sports figure or anybody like that. So that was very cool. And what else is going on in the world? Well, I'm sure we'll talk about things as we go down the line. I brought a few things with me to share with you. Some puns or jokes. And, of course, some music. Let's see. I think, actually, let me share. This is an important thing that we don't want to forget. So let me just do this. At the very beginning, we are WMFO.org, WMFO Medford, and stop the texts and stop the wrecks. A texting driver is 23 times more likely to get into a crash than a non-texting driver. Yeesh, that's a pretty strong fact. It's a public safety message from Stop Texts, Stop Wrecks.org. And WMFO in Medford, Tufts Educational Radio. Yeah, that's just plain, you know, asking for trouble, right? Okay, here we go, and hopefully this will work.
Thank you.
Incredibly, incredibly beautiful flute playing. That's Steve Gorn, and that's from his CD, Colors of the Mind. And the song is called Sita's Garden. He's just a masterful player. It's a wonderful, wonderful CD. I did an interview with him quite a few years back, and he's a real special, special person. So you're listening to WMFO Medford. This is The Voice Mobile. I'm your host, Joyce The Voice. And in light of certain things that have happened, I want to share an article by Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, who's sadly no longer with us, but he left an incredible wealth of videos and books and teachings. And this is an article from April 19th of 2017, and it's called The Mutation of Anti-Semitism. Now, some of you probably know that Whoopi Goldberg had misspoken The View and has been censured. She's now having to stay in the corner for 2 weeks. She described, she said that anti-Semitism wasn't about racism, and probably because in her mind that had to do more with being African-American or black. And so she got a lot of pushback, and I think she gets it, but, you know, words matter. And so I'm going to just share this article. In recent months and years, we have seen the return and rise of anti-Semitism across Europe and around the world. But how has anti-Semitism mutated over time? And why does it return, does its return today present a danger not just for Jews, but for all who care about our common humanity? So it's asking you to watch, because this was actually a video and a whitebird animation. And this is the transcript from the video. Within living memory of the Holocaust, after which the world said it would never happen again, anti-Semitism has returned. But what is anti-Semitism, and why should its return be cause for grave concern, not only for Jews, but for all of us? Historically, anti-Semitism has been hard to define, because it expresses itself in such contradictory ways. Before the Holocaust, Jews were hated because they were poor and because they were rich, because they were communists and because they were capitalists, because they kept to themselves and because they infiltrated everywhere, because they clung to ancient religious beliefs, and because they were rootless cosmopolitans who believed nothing. So, what is anti-Semitism? Let's be clear. Not liking people because they're different isn't anti-Semitism. It's xenophobia. Criticizing Israel isn't anti-Semitism. It's part of the democratic process, and Israel is a democracy. Anti-Semitism is something much more dangerous. It means persecuting Jews and denying them the right to exist collectively as Jews with the same rights as everyone else. It's a prejudice that, like a virus, has survived over time by mutating. So, in the Middle Ages, Jews were persecuted because of their religion. In the 19th and 20th centuries, they were reviled because of their race. Today, Jews are attacked because of the existence of their nation-state, Israel. Denying Israel's right to exist is the new anti-Semitism. And just as anti-Semitism has mutated, so has its legitimization. Each time, as the persecution descended into barbarity, the persecutors reached for the highest form of justification available. In the Middle Ages, it was religion. In post-Enlightenment Europe, it was science, the so-called scientific study of race. Today, it is human rights. Wherever you hear human rights evoked to deny Israel's right to exist, you are hearing the new anti-Semitism. So why has it returned? There are many reasons, but one root cause is the cognitive failure called scapegoating. When bad things happen to a group, its members can ask one of two questions. What did we do wrong? Or who did this to us? The entire fate of the group will depend on which it chooses. If it asks, what did we do wrong? It has begun the process of healing the harm. If instead it asks, who did this to us? It has defined itself as a victim. It will then seek a scapegoat to blame for all its problems. Classically, this has been the Jews, because for 1,000 years they were the most conspicuous non-Christian minority in Europe, and today because Israel is the most conspicuous non-Muslim country in the Middle East. The argument is always the same. We are innocent, therefore they are guilty. Therefore, if we are to be free, they, the Jews of the state of Israel, or the state of Israel, must be destroyed. That is how the great evils begin. Why, then, should we all care about this? After all, if we're not Jewish, what has it got to do with us? The answer is that anti-Semitism is about the inability of a group to make space for difference. And because we are all different, The hate that begins with Jews never ends with Jews. If it wasn't Jews alone who suffered under Hitler, It wasn't Jews alone who suffered under Stalin. It isn't Jews alone who suffer under the radical Islamists and others who deny Israel's right to exist. Anti-Semitism is the world's most reliable early warning sign of a major threat to freedom, humanity, and the dignity of difference. It matters to all of us, which is why we must fight it together.
Thank you. Thank you. ביצור לכל נפשי, קומה לכל מסורי, בירץ תהיו ביואי, בלי מויים.
ימה ממה ימה
thank you.
برایم مکن.
Yes, that was Mordechai Ben David, and the selection was His Vadus from Once Upon a Nigun. And before that, let's see if I can get us back to where I listed everything. Yeah, let's see. All right, mouse. All right, so before that, we listened to Zahara Menzies. Beautiful, beautiful guitar playing. Pasaje Cubano con Campanas. And it's a Latina release. And her husband was before that, Elliot Fisk. Partite sopra il balletto. And it's a composition by Girolamo Frescobaldi from the Best of Elliott Fisk. They're an incredible team. They are teachers as well as performers, and wonderful. They've both been guests here on the Voicemobile. So before that, we opened up with Sita's Garden, Steve Gorn, from Colors of the Mind. So, okay, I have something else I want to share with you. And this is an article on Golda Meir, the past president of the State of Israel, on the Palestinians and terror. This is from January 14th, 1976. Had Israel not repelled her would-be destroyers, no Jewish refugees would be alive in the Middle East to concern the world, from the New York Times 41 years ago. Nothing has changed. To be misquoted is an occupational hazard of political leadership. For this reason, I should like to clarify my position in regard to the Palestinian issue. I have been charged with being rigidly insensitive to the question of the Palestinian Arabs. In evidence of this, I am supposed to have said, there are no Palestinians. My actual words were, there is no Palestinian people. There are Palestinian refugees. The distinction is not semantic. My statement was based on a lifetime of debates with the Arab nationalists who vehemently excluded a separatist Palestinian Arab nationalism from their formulations. When in 1921 I came to Palestine, until the end of World War I, a barren, sparsely inhabited Turkish province, we, the Jewish pioneers, were the avowed Palestinians, so we were named in the world. Arab nationalists, on the other hand, stridently rejected the designation. Arab spokesmen continued to insist that the land we had cherished for centuries was, like Lebanon, merely a fragment of Syria, on the grounds that it had dismembered an ideal unitary Arab state. They fought before the Anglo-American Committee of Inquiry and at the United Nations. When the Arab historian Philip K. Hitti informed the Anglo-American Committee of Inquiry that, quote, there is no such thing as Palestine in history, unquote, it was left to David Ben-Gurion to stress the central role of Palestine in Jewish, if not Arab, history. As late as May 1956, Ahmed Sukkari, subsequently head of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, declared to the United Nations Security Council, it is common knowledge that Palestine is nothing but southern Syria. In view of this, I believe I may be forgiven if I took Arab spokesmen at their word. Until the 1960s, attention was focused on the Arab refugees, for whose plight the Arab states would allow no solution, though many constructive and far-reaching proposals were made by Israel and the world community. I repeatedly expressed my sympathy for the needless sufferings of refugees, whose abnormal situation was created and exploited by the Arab states as a tactic in their campaign against Israel. However, refugee status could not indefinitely be maintained for the original 550,000 Arabs who in 1948 joined the exodus from the battle areas during the Arab attack on the new state of Israel. When the refugee card began to wear thin, the Palestinian terrorist appeared on the scene, flourishing not the arguable claims of displaced refugees, but of a ghoulish nationalism that could only be sated on the corpse of Israel. When the refugee card began to wear thin, okay, I repeat again, we dispossessed no Arabs. Our toil in the deserts and marshes of Palestine created more habitable living space for both Arab and Jew. Until 1948, the Arabs of Palestine multiplied and flourished as a direct result of Zionist settlement. Whatever subsequent ills befell the Arabs were the inevitable result of the Arab design to drive us into the sea. Had Israel not repelled her would-be destroyers, there would have been no Jewish refugees alive in the Middle East to concern the world. Now, 2 years after the surprise attack of the Yom Kippur War, I am well aware of the potency of Arab petrobillions, and I have no illusions about the moral fiber of the United Nations, most of whose members hailed gun-toting Yasser Arafat and shamefully passed the anti-Semitic resolution that describes Zionism, the national liberation movement of the Jewish people, as racist. But although Israel is small and beset, I am not prepared to accede to the easy formula that in the Arab-Israeli conflict, we witness two equal contending rights that demand further flexibility, quote-unquote, from Israel. Justice was not violated when in the huge territories liberated by the Allies from the Sultan, 1% was set aside for the Jewish homeland and its ancestral site, while in a parallel settlement, 99% of the area was allotted for the establishment of independent Arab states. We successively accepted the truncation of Transjordan, 3/4 of the area of historic Palestine, and finally the painful compromise of the 1947 partition resolution in the hope for peace. Yet, though Israel arose in only 1/5 of the territory originally assigned for the Jewish homeland, the Arabs invaded the young state. I ask again, as I have often asked, why did the Arabs not set up a Palestinian state in their portion? Instead of cannibalizing the country by Jordan's seizure of the West Bank and Egypt's capture of the Gaza Strip, and since the question of the 1967 borders looms heavily in the present discussions, why did the Arabs converge upon us in June 1967, when the West Bank, the Golan Heights, the Sinai, the Gaza Strip, and Old Jerusalem were in their hands? These are not idle questions. They go to the heart of the matter, the Arab denial of Israel's right to exist. This right is not subject to debate. That is why Israel cannot, by its presence, sanction the participation of the Palestine Liberation Organization at the Security Council, a participation in direct violation of Resolutions 242 and 338. We have no common language with exultant murderers of the innocent and with a terrorist movement ideologically committed to the liquidation of Jewish national independence. At no point has the PLO renounced its program for the elimination of the Zionist entity. With startling effrontery, PLO spokesmen admit that their proposed state on the West Bank would merely be a convenient point of departure, a tactical first stage, and finally, a combatant arsenal strategically situated for the easier penetration of Israel. I am often asked a hypothetical question. How would we react if the PLO agreed to abandon its weapon, terror, and its goal, the destruction of Israel? The answer is simple. Any movement that forswore both its means and its end would, by that fact, become a different organization with a different leadership. There is no room for such speculation in the case of the PLO. This does not mean that at this stage I disregard whatever national aspirations Palestinian Arabs have developed in recent years. However, these can be satisfied within the boundaries of historic Palestine. The majority of the refugees never left Palestine. They are settled on the West Bank and in Jordan, the majority of whose population is Palestinian, whatever nomenclature is used. Both the people involved and the territory on which they live are Palestinian. A mini-Palestinian state planted as a time bomb against Israel on the West Bank would only serve as a focal point for the further exploitation of regional tensions by the Soviet Union. But in a genuine peace settlement, a viable Palestine-Jordan could flourish side by side with Israel within the original area of Mandatory Palestine. On July 21, 1974, the Israeli government passed the following resolution. The peace will be founded on the existence of two independent states only, Israel with united Jerusalem as its capital, and a Jordan-Palestinian Arab state east of Israel, within borders to be determined in negotiations between Israel and Jordan. All allied problems can be equitably solved. For this to happen, the adversaries of Israel will have to stop devising overt schemes for her immediate or piecemeal extinction. There are 21 Arab states rich in oil, land, and sovereignty. There is only one small state in which Jewish national independence has been dearly achieved. Surely it is not extravagant to demand that in the current power play, the right of a small democracy to freedom and life not be betrayed. A statement by Golda Meir on the Palestinians and on terror from 1976. Well, has much changed? Probably not. All right, this is WMFO Medford, and you're listening to The Voice Mobile. I am your host, Joyce the Voice.